The Blithedale Romance by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Chapter 28. Blithedale Pasture. Blithedale, thus far in its progress, had never found the necessity of a burial ground. There was some consultation among us in what spot Zenobia might most fitly be laid. It was my own wish that she should sleep at the base of Eliot's pulpit, and that, on the rugged front of the rock, the name by which we familiarly knew her, Zenobia, and not another word, should be deeply cut and left for the moss and lichens to fill up at their long leisure. But Hollingsworth, to whose ideas on this point great deference was due, made it his request that her grave might be dug on the gently sloping hillside in the wide pasture where, as we once supposed, Zenobia and he had planned to build their cottage. And thus it was done accordingly. She was buried very much as other people have been for hundreds of years gone by. In anticipation of a death, we Blithedale colonists had sometimes set our fancies at work to arrange a funereal ceremony which should be the proper symbolic expression of our spiritual faith and eternal hopes. And this we meant to substitute for those customary rites which were molded originally out of the Gothic gloom, and by long use, like an old velvet pall, have so much more than their first death smell in them. But when the occasion came, we found it the simplest and truest thing, after all, to content ourselves with the old fashion, taking away what we could, but interpolating no novelties, and particularly avoiding all frippery of flowers and cheerful emblems. The procession moved from the farmhouse. Nearest the dead walked an old man in deep mourning, his face most concealed in a white handkerchief, and with Priscilla leaning on his arm. Hollingsworth and myself came next. We all stood around the narrow niche in the cold earth, all saw the coffin lowered in, all heard the rattle of the crumbly soil upon its lid, that final sound which mortality awakens on the utmost verge of sense, as if in the vain hope of bringing an echo from the spiritual world. I noticed a stranger to most of those present, though known to me, who, after the coffin had descended, took up a handful of earth and flung it first into the grave. I had given up Hollingsworth's arm, and now found myself near this man. "It was an idle thing, a foolish thing for Zenobia to do," said he. "She was the last woman in the world to whom death could have been necessary. It was too absurd. I have no patience with her." "Why so?" I inquired, smothering my horror at his cold comment in my eager curiosity to discover some tangible truth as to his relationship with Zenobia. If any crisis could justify the sad wrong she offered to herself, it was surely that in which she stood. Everything had failed her. Prosperity in the world's sense, for her opulence was gone, the heart's prosperity in love. And there was a secret burthen on her, the nature of which is best known to you. Young as she was, she had tried life fully, had no more to hope and something perhaps to fear. Had Providence taken her away in its own holy hand, I should have thought it the kindest dispensation that could be awarded to one so wrecked. "You mistake the matter completely," rejoined Westervelt. "What, then, is your own view of it?" I asked. "Her mind was active and various in its powers," said he. "Her heart had a manifold adaptation, her constitution an infinite buoyancy, which, had she possessed only a little patience to await the reflux of her troubles, would have borne her upward triumphantly for 20 years to come. Her beauty would not have waned, or scarcely so, and surely not beyond the reach of art to restore it, in all that time. She had life's summer all before her, and 100 varieties of brilliant success. What an actress Zenobia might have been! It was one of her least valuable capabilities. How forcibly she might have wrought upon the world, either directly in her own person, or by her influence upon some man, or a series of men of controlling genius. Every prize that could be worth a woman's having, and many prizes which other women are too timid to desire, lay within Zenobia's reach." "In all this," I observed, "there would have been nothing to satisfy her heart."
"Her heart!" answered Westervelt contemptuously. "That troublesome organ, as she had hitherto found it, would have been kept in its due place and degree, and have had all the gratification it could fairly claim. She would soon have established a control over it. Love had failed her, you say. Had it Never failed her before, yet she survived it and loved again, possibly not once alone nor twice either, and now to drown herself for yonder dreamy philanthropist. "Who are you?" I exclaimed indignantly, "that dare to speak thus of the dead? You seem to intend a eulogy, yet leave out whatever was noblest in her and blacken while you mean to praise. I have long considered you as Zenobia's evil fate. Your sentiments confirm me in the idea, but leave me still ignorant as to the mode in which you have influenced her life. The connection may have been indissoluble, except by death. Then, indeed, always in the hope of God's infinite mercy, I cannot deem it a misfortune that she sleeps in yonder grave." "No matter what I was to her," he answered gloomily, yet without actual emotion, "she is now beyond my reach. Had she lived and hearkened to my counsels, we might have served each other well. But there Zenobia lies in yonder pit, with the dull earth over her, 20 years of a brilliant lifetime thrown away for a mere woman's whim. Heaven deal with Westervelt according to his nature and deserts. That is to say, annihilate him. He was altogether earthy, worldly, made for time and its gross objects, and incapable, except by a sort of dim reflection caught from other minds, of so much as one spiritual idea. Whatever stain Zenobia had was caught from him, nor does it seldom happen that a character of admirable qualities loses its better life because the atmosphere that should sustain it is rendered poisonous by such breath as this man mingled with Zenobia's. Yet his reflections possessed their share of truth. It was a woeful thought that a woman of Zenobia's diversified capacity should have fancied herself irretrievably defeated on the broad battlefield of life and with no refuge save to fall on her own sword merely because love had gone against her. It is nonsense and a miserable wrong, the result, like so many others, of masculine egotism, that the success or failure of woman's existence should be made to depend wholly on the affections and on one species of affection. While man has such a multitude of other chances that this seems but an incident. For its own sake, if it will do no more, the world should throw open all its avenues to the passport of a woman's bleeding heart. As we stood around the grave, I looked often towards Priscilla, dreading to see her wholly overcome with grief. And deeply grieved, in truth, she was. But a character so simply constituted as hers has room only for a single predominant affection. No other feeling can touch the heart's inmost core, nor do it any deadly mischief. Thus, while we see that such a being responds to every breeze with tremulous vibration and imagine that she must be shattered by the first rude blast, we find her retaining her equilibrium amid shocks that might have overthrown many a sturdier frame. So with Priscilla. Her one possible misfortune was Hollingsworth's unkindness, and that was destined never to befall her. Never yet, at least, for Priscilla has not died. But Hollingsworth, after all the evil that he did, are we to leave him thus, blessed with the entire devotion of this one true heart, and with wealth at his disposal to execute the long-contemplated project that had led him so far astray? What retribution is there here? My mind being vexed with precisely this query, I made a journey some years since for the sole purpose of catching a last glimpse at Hollingsworth and judging for myself whether he were a happy man or no. I learned that he inhabited a small cottage, that his way of life was exceedingly retired, and that my only chance of encountering him or Priscilla was to meet them in a secluded lane where, in the latter part of the afternoon, they were accustomed to walk. I did meet them, accordingly. As they approached me, I observed in Hollingsworth's face a depressed and melancholy look that seemed habitual. The powerfully built man showed a self-distrustful weakness and a childlike or childish tendency to press close, and closer still, to the side of the slender woman whose arm was within his. In Priscilla's manner there was a protective and watchful quality, as if she felt herself the guardian of her companion, but likewise a deep, submissive, unquestioning reverence, and also a veiled happiness in her fair and quiet countenance. Drawing nearer, Priscilla recognized me and gave me a kind and friendly smile, but with a slight gesture which I could not help interpreting as an entreaty not to make myself known to Hollingsworth. Nevertheless, an impulse took possession of me and compelled me to address him. "I have come, Hollingsworth," said I, "to view your grand edifice for the reformation of criminals. Is it finished yet?"
"No, nor begun," answered he, without raising his eyes. "A very small one answers all my purposes."
Priscilla threw me an upbraiding glance, but I spoke again with a bitter and revengeful emotion, as if flinging a poisoned arrow at Hollingsworth's heart.
"Up to this moment," I inquired, "how many criminals have you reformed?"
"Not one," said Hollingsworth, with his eyes still fixed on the ground. "Ever since we parted, I have been busy with a single murderer."
Then the tears gushed into my eyes, and I forgave him, for I remembered the wild energy, the passionate shriek with which Zenobia had spoken those words. "Tell him he has murdered me. Tell him that I'll haunt him." And I knew what murderer he meant, and whose vindictive shadow dogged the side where Priscilla was not.
The moral, which presents itself to my reflections as drawn from Hollingsworth's character and errors, is simply this, that, admitting what is called philanthropy, when adopted as a profession, to be often useful by its energetic impulse to society at large, it is perilous to the individual whose ruling passion, in one exclusive channel, it thus becomes. It ruins, or is fearfully apt to ruin, the heart, the rich juices of which God never meant should be pressed violently out and distilled into alcoholic liquor by an unnatural process, but should render life sweet, bland, and gently beneficent, and insensibly influence other hearts and other lives to the same blessed end. I see in Hollingsworth an exemplification of the most awful truth in Bunyan's book of such, "From the very gate of heaven there is a byway to the pit." But all this while we have been standing by Zenobia's grave. I have never since beheld it, but make no question that the grass grew all the better on that little parallelogram of pastureland for the decay of the beautiful woman who slept beneath. How much nature seems to love us, and how readily, nevertheless, without a sigh or a complaint, she converts us to a meaner purpose when her highest one, that of conscious intellectual life and sensibility, has been untimely balked. While Zenobia lived, nature was proud of her, and directed all eyes upon that radiant presence as her fairest handiwork. Zenobia perished. Will not nature shed a tear?
Ah, no.
She adopts the calamity at once into her system, and is just as well pleased, for aught we can see, with the tuft of ranker vegetation that grew out of Zenobia's heart, as with all the beauty which has bequeathed us no earthly representative, except in this crop of weeds. It is because the spirit is inestimable that the lifeless body is so little valued. The end of chapter 28. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.